You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book, as always, features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Geraldine Brooks, whose latest novel is Caleb's Crossing. Australian-born Geraldine Brooks is an author and journalist who grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney and attended Bethlehem College, Ashfield, and the University of Sydney. She worked as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald for 3 years as a feature writer with a special interest in environmental issues. In 1982, Geraldine Brooks won the Greg Shackleton Australian News Correspondence Scholarship to the Journalism Master's Program at Columbia University in New York City. Later, she worked for the Wall Street Journal, where she covered crises in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2006 for her novel, March. Her first novel, Year of Wonders, is an international bestseller. And People of the Book is a New York Times bestseller translated into 20 languages. She's also the author of the nonfiction works Nine Parts of Desire and Foreign Correspondence. Geraldine Brooks lives with her husband, the author Tony Horwitz, and two sons on Martha's Vineyard. They try to get back to Sydney as often as possible. In writing her new book, Caleb's Crossing, Geraldine Brooks once again takes a remarkable shard of history and brings it to life. In 1665, a young man from Martha's Vineyard became the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College. Upon this slender, factual scaffold, Brooks has created a tale of love and faith, magic and adventure. The narrator of Caleb's Crossing is Bethia Mayfield, growing up in the tiny settlement of Great Harbor amid a small band of pioneers and Puritans. Restless and curious, she yearns after an education that is closed to her by her sex. As often as she can, she slips away to explore the island's glistening beaches and observe its native Wampanoag inhabitants. At 12, Bethia encounters Caleb, the young son of a chieftain, and the two forge a tentative secret friendship that draws each into the alien world of the other. Bethia's minister father tries to convert the Wampanoag, awakening the wrath of the island's strongest Pawa, against whose ritual magic he must test his own beliefs. One of his projects becomes the education of Caleb, and a year later, Caleb is in Cambridge studying Latin and Greek among the colonial elite. Bethia, also in Cambridge at the behest of her imperious elder brother, finds herself enmeshed in Caleb's fate as he crosses between cultures. When I spoke to Geraldine Brooks last week, I asked her to begin by talking about Caleb Chishatamok, the historical figure on whose life she based this novel.
Unfortunately, we know so little about this extraordinary life. The written record is sadly scant. We know that he was born on the island now known as Martha's Vineyard, around about 1646, and that meant that we can pretty much surmise that he was raised as a traditional Wampanoag in the band that lived in Nognocket, which is now known as Westchop. And his father was the Songkhem, or leader of that band. There were several bands of Wampanoag across the island with traditional lands for hunting and gardening and so forth. And so the English settlement at that time was tiny and 10 miles away, and there wasn't a lot of contact in the first few years of the English settlement between the Wampanoag and the English. It was kind of each side letting each other alone. There were about 3,000 Wampanoag and perhaps, you know, 30 or 40 English settlers. So at some point, I think that Caleb attended a school that was started in the 1650s by one of the English settlers who was the settlement minister and also became very much involved in the project of converting the Wampanoag to Christianity. And he came at this through education, and he started the first school on the island for Wampanoag children, actually. And the Wampanoag were very interested in the opportunity to become literate in their own language, even more so than English, and they embraced this chance straight away because they could see the utility of a written language at a time when native culture was already under huge stress, and on the mainland epidemics had already wiped out bands and lots of knowledge had been lost. So the Wampanoag embraced becoming literate right from the get-go, more or less. And Caleb was part of that project, and he and another Wampanoag youth were sent with the son of the minister off the island to the mainland to attend a high-powered Latin prep school that would get them ready to attend Harvard College, which was a fledgling institution. Although it had been going for 25 years, it was still a struggling school, but offering a very rigorous classics-based four-year degree that was already recognized as the equivalent of the degrees offered by Oxford and Cambridge. So so that is what he did, and he successfully matriculated and completed his course of studies and graduated with a pretty elite band of classmates in 1665. The group included the son of the late Governor Dudley and the famous preacher John Eliot's son and a number of other colonial luminary son, so it was a considerable elite that Caleb became a part of on his graduation.
And how did you learn about him?
I learned about him from the Wampanoag tribe on Martha's Vineyard, who've never been displaced from their traditional lands. I mean, they've been displaced from quite a bit of them, but they still have a thriving community on the island, you know, with millennial roots, and they're very proud custodians of their history, and I wanted to know more about my new neighbors, and I gathered up some materials that the tribe had prepared, and among them was a map, and on that map was a notation that this was the birthplace of the first Native American to graduate from Harvard, and my eye was prepared to read 1965 because I was thinking civil rights movement and resurgence of Native American political activism and all that. When I saw 1665, I just did a complete double take, and my brain started spinning with questions about how had this come about at such an early period, and who was this young man, and what was Harvard, and how had this come to be, and what was it like to be him? And to me, that sort of series of questions coming at you is often the symptom of the onset of a novel.
How large is that community now on the vineyard?
I want to say that the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinna is over 1,000 individuals. They're not all on the island at any one time. Then there's another Wampanoag community on the mainland. But the community here is very active in environmental and cultural stewardship of the lands and the old life ways of the past, and so there are very rich resources here to learn from.
Now, I read that the second member of that same tribe from the vineyard just graduated from Harvard just recently. Is that true? Is that correct?
The second Wampanoag just completed her undergraduate degree, the same degree that Caleb achieved in 1665. There are other members of the tribe who have done graduate studies successfully at Harvard, but she's the first one to graduate from the college since Caleb, and that was Tiffany Smalley. So that was a remarkable event and much celebrated. Mm-hmm. And Harvard used it as an opportunity to bestow a posthumous degree on Joel Iokumis, who went to Harvard alongside Caleb and completed the requirements for his degree but was tragically killed on his way back to the commencement ceremony in 1665. So Harvard finally recognized his achievement too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's so wonderful, I think, for the Wampanoag community and probably for Harvard as well, that your book has come out exactly when it has. And
it was quite the coincidence. Writing about 1665, you don't expect to find yourself writing about something that's suddenly newsworthy, but there you have it.
Yeah.
It's a perfect piece of timing.
That's great. Your narrator, is Bethia, and she's a fictional character. She's the daughter of a Puritan minister who befriends Caleb and acts as a teacher to him. And I was wondering how easy or difficult you found it to access Bethia's voice and vocabulary as you tried to write your way into this novel.
Initially, it was extremely difficult because there are no... What I usually do in finding a voice for a character is read lots of contemporary journals and letters, and the sad fact was that in colonial America, women were not encouraged to write, nor did they have the time to do so. You know, they were laboring from before dawn to after dark, making every single thing that you needed to survive, from, you know, shearing the sheep to weaving the cloth, to making the clothes, to boiling the water to wash the clothes. So they didn't have a lot of time to sit around and contemplate their existence. And also Puritans believed that while women should be taught to read their Bible, writing was not an essential skill for women, because writing was how you communicate with people outside the family, and why would a woman need to do that?
Yeah.
So there were not so many women whose literacy extended to writing skills. And so there are no extant journals and very few letters before 1700. And so for Bethia's voice, I had to go to unusual places, like the religious courts and the magistrates' courts, where women would be hauled in, accused of various crimes, like being a scold, which basically meant they'd been overheard criticizing a man in public.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm very glad that that one's not on the books anymore. And anyway, but you can hear women speaking in their own voices. The transcript is often verbatim, so that was useful. And also I relied on the poetry of Anne Bradstreet and the testimony of Anne Hutchison when she was accused of heresy and hauled into court by the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so, you know, there are these few women whose voices have come down to us, and I tried to imagine Bethia's voice very much influenced by them.
And it's Bethia, not Bethia.
Well, it's Bethia in my head, and even though a couple of people whose names are actually Bethia say it's Bethia, I can't get used to it, so
yeah.
It'll always be Bethia for me.
My parents always told me my name was Shayla, and everybody tells me it's Sheila, and I just say, well, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you to read a few pages from Caleb's Crossing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this is Bethia, who's been told that she isn't going to be allowed to study anymore because she already knows how to read her Bible and recite her catechism. She finds this very hard to submit to, and she finds herself a bit like Prometheus stealing fire. She steals learning wherever she can.
Yes.
By overhearing her brother's classes with his father. Her brother is being prepared to go to Harvard College, and he's learning Latin and elementary Greek, so she listens in and struggles to absorb that. And then she uses the island as her teacher, and she, when she's not supposedly gathering food, she's studying the natural history of the island. And so that's where we take up the story.
Okay, great.
On one bright day, when the weather had warmed and steadied, I rode Speckle to the south shore. The prospect is remarkable there, where the wide white sands run uninterrupted for many leagues. I watched the heaving waves, smooth as glass, unspooling down the rim of my known world. I dismounted my boots, stripped my hose, and let the sea foam froth about my toes. I led the mare along the rack line, studying white shells shaped like angels' wings, and bleached bones light as air, which I took to be from a seabird. I picked up scallop shells in diverse colors and sizes, warm reds and yellows, cool stippled grays, and reflected on the diversity of God's creation. And what might be the use and meaning of his making so many varieties of a single thing? If he created scallops simply for our nourishment, why paint each shell with delicate and particular colors? And why, indeed, trouble to make so many different things to nourish us, when in the Bible we read that a simple manna fed the Hebrews day following day? It came to me then that God must desire us to use each of our senses to take delight in the varied tastes and sights and textures of his world. Yet this seemed to go against so many of our preachments, against the sumptuary and the carnal. Puzzling upon it, I had walked some good distance, head down, inattentive to all but my thoughts, when I glanced up and saw them far off, a band of them, painted strangely as I had been told they did for war, running headlong up the beach in my direction. I grasped Eccles' bridle and urged her in all haste into the dunes, which were high and undulant and concealing. I was cursing my folly to find myself alone, far from help, and my mare, hard-ridden, fairly spent. But in the lee of the dune, protected from the wind, the voices of the band carried toward me. They were laughing and calling out one to another. The sounds were of merriment, not warfare. Taking care that Steckle remained well concealed, I crept along to a parting between the sandhills from whence I could look back along the beach. I saw then what my first fear had obscured for me. They were unarmed, carrying neither bow nor war club. I raised a hand to shade my eyes against the glare and could make out a small sphere of tied-up skins, which they were kicking high into the air, and I knew then that they were about some kind of game. I had to look away then, for they were clad in Adam's livery. Fortunately, they were so intent on their game that they had not seen me. I led Speckle some distance to where I was sure the height of the dune would conceal me. I had to do the chore that I had been sent out for, to gather sufficient clams for our chowder kettle. So when I had put some distance between myself and the beach, I tied Speckle to a great piece of driftwood, unfastened the rake from the saddle, hitched my skirt high, and waded into the brine. It soon proved a poor place, and I was about to give up and try another spot when I felt eyes upon me. I straightened and turned. Saw him for the first time, the boy we now call Caleb. He was standing in a thicket of tall beech grass, his bow slung over one shoulder, and some kind of dead waterfowl in the bag at his back. Something, perhaps my frantic tugging at my skirt, amused him, for he smiled. He was, I judged, a youth of my own age, some 2 or 3 years younger than the warriors that play upon the beach. Unlike them, he was clad for hunting, wearing a kind of deerskin breech clout tied with a belt fashioned of snake skins. All else about him was open and naked, save for 3 glossy feathers tied into a sort of topknot in his thick, jetty hair. His smile was unguarded, his teeth very fine and white, and something in his expression made it impossible to fear him. Still, I thought it prudent to retrieve my mare and get away from this place, which seemed to be teeming with salvages of one sort or another. Who could say what outlandish person might next appear? I gathered up my soaking skirt and made for the shoreline. Unfortunately, in my haste, I caught my toe in a thicket of eel grass and tripped into the water. He was beside me in a few long strides. A hard brown grip on my forearm pulled me out of the water. In his own language, I asked him to let go. His hand dropped from my arm. I made my way, dripping, to shore. He stood where he was, fixed to the spot by his own astonishment. It was my turn then to struggle against a smile. I think it would not have surprised him more had my horse addressed him.
Thank you very much. That's a wonderful section. I love that. I love that they are also initially interested in each other, sort of around language and the differences of language and the curiosity about each other's language.
Well, yes, because they have to understand each other, and she has a slight advantage because she's overheard her father trying to learn Wampanoag language so that he can convert the Indians, and has made his first convert, and that man, Aya Coombs, is coming to the house to teach her father, and so she's got a few phrases when she meets Caleb.
Yeah.
And then together they teach each other their words for things.
I also think that even though it's very unlucky that there's not more writing that survived by women from this period in time, I think the fact that she is so curious about her world makes her a wonderful narrator. And the fact that women were dissuaded from learning and studying, it makes her, you know, a person who would probably be more likely to reach out and want this experience.
Yeah, well, I was very much inspired by Anne Bradstreet in this. Well, her father did encourage her intellectual curiosities, and that was pretty unusual in the period. But luckily, we do have her letters and poems, and we can get a kind of quite interesting insight into what women were thinking, and the fact that, you know, much to our astonishment sometimes, I think we're a little vain as 21st century women to think that we came up with feminism. But actually, women have been thinking these things for a very long time, and it's very clear in Bradstreet's poetry, and one of my favorites is her poem about Queen Elizabeth I. And I'm going to mangle this now, but she writes, "Now say, did women have wit once, but now have none, and with our blessed queen 'tis gone. Let those who say our sex is devoid of reason know 'tis slander now, but once was treason." So, you know, they were really onto it. And sometimes I get giving my 17th century female protagonists modern views, that, believe me, women had those views. We're not the first one to come up with the fact that there was inequity.
Right, right. Well, actually, mentioning the period outlook versus contemporary outlooks brings me to my next question, and that is, how did you decide what was acceptable to fictionalize and what would be too great a stretch of the imagination for your reader, maybe to keep the novel honest?
Yeah, well, I try and stick with the line of fact as far as it leads, because I actually think truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, the thing, you know, when you hear that phrase, you couldn't make that up. It's because something happened that is so unlikely that if you used it in a novel, nobody. And, you know, my favorite story in that regard is I was watching Oprah Winfrey one day, and there was a story about a woman who was filming her boyfriend sports fishing, and this magnificent swordfish that he had, that he was struggling with, suddenly made a turn and leapt into the boat and speared her through the chest as she was videotaping. And she should have died, but she was saved because the gooey contents of her silicon breast implant saved her.
Oh, my God.
And you couldn't make that up, right? So I often think of that story, and so I try and, you know, find out what really happened. And, you know, when the line of fact runs out, then you have to fill the void with imagination. But it should be an informed empathy that you use. So I try and not go too hog wild. And if I do depart from the known facts, I always come clean about that in the afterword, mm-hmm. so that readers can make the distinction between what really happened and what is my wild novelist's invention. And I think that that's really the limit of a novelist's responsibility, is to, you know, to have an afterword like that. And anything else, I think you have to have a great story or it's not really a legitimate novel. So I'm not a narrative historian, and I do not pretend to be. And the beauty of being a novelist as opposed to a journalist, which I was for many years, is that you do have the freedom to a certain extent, make it come out the way you want. Mm-hmm. But and in this regard, I don't want to give away the ending of the book. And it certainly doesn't come out the way I would have wanted. So, but I really couldn't distort the history to give a traditionally happy ending to this story. The challenge of writing it in a way was to clear my head from knowing what was coming, because at this point in the 1660s, you know, there's still a chance that history in this country could have taken a different path of reconciliation between the peoples and a sharing of the land. And so my characters don't know that it's all going to end in bloodshed and violence and dispossession and disease and, you know, beyond decimation for the native occupants of the country. They are still optimistic, so I had to try and imbue the novel with optimism as far as I could. Yeah. And then, you know, the portents of what is going to happen start the drumbeat towards the end. But I didn't feel free to make it all sunny, so without giving away what happens, that's kind of my thinking towards
right.
the end.
And without giving away what happens in the novel, I will just mention that the Harvard's Indian College did actually get shut down after all the bloodshed that you're mentioning in the historical record.
Well, there had been prequels of violent incidents, but the massive war that broke out, that's known as King Philip's War in 1775, more or less put an end to any ideas about Indian youth being educated alongside the English, even though it's stated in Harvard's charter that this is the mission of the college, the education of English and Indian youth in knowledge and godliness. But that idealistic vision was completely destroyed by the bloodshed of this year-long, incredibly brutal war, which the Wampanoag almost won and looked like they were winning for the first half until the British used divide-and-conquer tactics. And so the English turned their back very comprehensively on the Indian College. It fell into disrepair and was torn down, and Harvard more or less forgot its own history for a couple of centuries. And to the extent that they didn't even know where the English College, the Indian College, had stood. And it's only in the last 2 years that archaeological efforts have located the college. And this summer, the dig will reopen, and they will be able to go straight down to the 17th century level, and hopefully we will learn more about the lives of these remarkable young scholars as that project proceeds.
And nothing's been built on top of it?
Yeah, sort of, but there's still plenty of the area of the college that is not built upon.
Okay.
It's in Harvard Yard, luckily. It's very fascinating when the dig is underway and they're pulling up. You know, what's written down is one thing, and what goes into the trash is something else. And what goes into the trash often sheds new light on what's written down, because what's written down is a very strict set of rules. A lot of scholars are supposed to comport themselves and no smoking and no drinking. But the things that come out of this dig are all broken pipes and broken, you know, bottles of hard liquor. And and they're also Puritans, so they weren't supposed to have ornate dress, but there's so many fancy buttons and gewgaws and, you know, so... you know, there's one picture that we get from the very sincere writings and another from the actual artifacts that survive.
Sure. Early in the book, Bathia says, it's a much longer sentence, but she starts a sentence by saying, "I have often wondered if what happened later had its roots in this," and then she goes on to think about something. And I'm just wondering... at that point in the book, which is very early in the book, did you know what was going to happen, or did you go back and write these early pages later after you had written your way into the story, perhaps?
No, I did write it chronologically. I tend to do that. Then, you know, sometimes I'll come to an early bit and I'll leave it till later. Mm-hmm. And that's why books are often so hard to finish, because all those gnarly bits are waiting to be readdressed at the end.
Right.
But in this case, I had the arc of the story, but I didn't know where I was going to stop telling it, you know. So at first, I had it in my mind that I would stop at the very triumphant point where Caleb graduates. And then it occurred to me that that was, you know, so untrue to the history that I was going to have to deal with some of the harder issues. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that the arc would be wider and longer. And but I wasn't sure how it was going to be told. And in the end, the last part of the story is told in retrospect. The book is in the form of more or less secret or private writings that Bathia feels compelled to do at three stages in her life.
Mm-hmm.
One, just before Caleb comes to live with her family to be prepared for Harvard. One, when she is in Cambridge working as a servant in the college, because that's the only place women could be found there. And the third is at the end of her life, when she's reflecting on choices that she made and their consequences. And it was in that retrospective, very meditative section that I decided to deal with these issues. So it doesn't unfold in the real time of the novel, but as meditation on what occurred from the point of view of a very elderly woman at that point.
Mm-hmm. I was very upset when I read the section about the whale washing up on the beach, and It was so upsetting to understand, and I know this still goes on in various countries, but the practice of carving up whales who had washed up on the beach while they were still alive. And I wondered if you included this in order to make a distinction between the native practices regarding animals and the way that the Puritans treated this kind of situation.
Well, it's definitely a completely... a worldview that is completely at odds between this band of... religious zealots, basically, who've been impelled across the world on the winds of their own religious conviction, but their religious conviction contains the belief that man was created to subdue the earth. Mm-hmm. And that comes into conflict with, and I don't want to do the whole, you know, Native Americans were perfect ecological saints. Mm-hmm. Because I think we overdo that. But there was certainly a lighter tread on the earth and an understanding that you don't deplete, even if you do think of animals and plants as a resource, they're a resource that needs to be sustained. And I think that that becomes very, very clear. Mm-hmm. And luckily, on the vineyard, we do have early Native American writings because the Wampanoag did become literate at this extremely early period. So we do have their views on these things and their shock at the way the English went about existing on the island, the way, you know, the excess, for instance, what it took to heat an English house in terms of timber felling was so much greater than what the Wampanoag needed to heat their wetu or their domed bark huts. They could have a tiny little fire, and because of the design of their hut, it would be cozy, you know, through the harsh winter, whereas the English houses were poorly sited and really, really substantial fires going all the time just to keep warm. And so, the forests around the English settlement quickly were logged out, and the Indians also didn't understand why you would turn the earth upside down, which was what they thought plowing was, because you have this perfectly good vegetation that feeds the deer that feeds you, and instead the English come in and turn the earth upside down so that nothing's growing there, so that then they have the effort of having to plant it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's quite fascinating to look through these different sets of eyes.
Yeah.
And the whaling scene, yeah, I guess it was a run at that, but it's also such a huge part of what life was like on these islands.
Right.
That only became more so as time went on. I mean, it's a very formative part,
yeah,
of the history of the vineyard and Nantucket.
It also gave Bethia a reason to sort of turn away from the beach because she was so upset. And at that point, she witnesses a Native American ceremony that includes dancing. And I was wondering if you've ever participated or witnessed any of these rituals or dances, either on Martha's Vineyard or elsewhere.
Yes, luckily there's a powwow here every late summer, and there are some incredibly gifted dancers in the tribe, and it is absolutely inspiring to watch these different forms of dance, the men's dance, which is incredibly athletic and often to do with mock warfare or hunting, the women's dance, which really is very interesting because there's different ways of approaching it depending on a woman's stage of life, but it's a completely different form and has its own beauty and, you know, stateliness. And I've been really lucky in that regard to have all this, have my neighbors who are so well versed in all these beautiful arts.
And that's open to the public? Anybody can go to see the powwows?
Absolutely, yeah. It's encouraged, and it's the tribe uses it as, you know, as a real opportunity to teach more about Eastern woodland culture, because for a long time that culture was so suppressed, and all anybody thought of, it, you say Native American, everybody thinks of a Plains Indian on a horse with a war bonnet, you know, whereas there's this completely other rich culture of our part of you know, and even the notion of Native American or Indian was not one that people in the 17th century had about themselves. They were Wampanoag, or they were Sioux, or they were Narragansett. They were not all one thing any more than an Italian is a Swede.
Well, I wanted to also talk a little bit about the religious depictions in the book. I loved the following sentence from Bathia, who in this scene is considering what she sees as the outlandishness of some of the stories that young Caleb has told her about his people's gods and beliefs. And she says, "But as I rode home that afternoon, it came to me that our story of a burning bush and a parted sea might also seem fabulous to one not raised up knowing it was true." I thought that was so perfect. I loved
that. Thank you. I was lucky because I was able to draw on fantastic journals by the handful of early missionaries. And John Cotton particularly was sent to the island because he had got himself into a spot of bother. I think it was lewd behavior with a young woman was what he was accused of, and he had to go and purge himself by serving as a missionary on Martha's Vineyard. And he writes down a lot of the questions and comments that he had to deal with in trying to, you know, sell this really hard sell. I mean, my favorite, and I've used it in the book, is you know, they would not concede that they had sinned. You know, he's trying to tell
yes.
them about sin, and they don't buy it.
Yeah.
And he's saying they would not concede that they had sinned and seemed very much affronted when I assured them of it. And then he tells them about original sin, and one of them makes the extremely astute observation that even if this man, Adam, displeased your God, why should he be angry with me about it, who only learned of it this day? So I had rich pickings there, and that's
yeah.
the beauty of why I think I love historical fiction so much, is that there are wonderful gems in the record
yeah.
to be found, and then you can put them to use in your fiction.
Right. Well, in this book, you write about Puritans and about Native Americans, and then in People of the Book, you wrote about Jews and Muslims. And I wondered if you could talk about writing from the perspective of a character who strictly adheres to a belief system that you yourself might not share.
I really, you know, I find myself drawn over and over again to these issues of what does religion do for you and what does it do to you. And
right.
I'm really intrigued by people who can really embrace an entire code of being. I spent some time when I was a foreign correspondent living with an Orthodox Jewish family in Israel, and, you know, there's 613 laws, and they try and live by as many of them as are relevant to their daily life, including, you know, kosher dietary laws and Sabbath observance, where you must not create anything for 24 hours. And when I asked this woman how she could possibly believe that it matters if a tiny insect gets into the food, because that, you know, almost invisible little gnat or something that she's scouring the vegetable for is not kosher. She says, you know, it's like when you get a new refrigerator and it comes with a set of directions. You follow the directions. These are the directions for my life, and
mm-hmm.
I have to follow them to the letter if I'm not going to break the machine. And I don't live that way, so it always fascinates me to encounter people who do.
And also just writing about the people who believe different things but maybe have a similar approach to their belief system, that seems to be something that interests you.
I'm interested in just, you know, I guess I was raised to try and see it from the other guy's point of view, and
yeah.
and I guess I took that to heart. And so one of the things that fascinates me is I'm not trying to get behind the eyeballs of somebody whose entire worldview is completely different from mine.
Yeah. yeah.
And I really love the exercise of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you already mentioned that another man, Joel Iacumis, studied at Harvard, but he died just before graduation.
That's right, yeah. He went all the way through the prep schools with Caleb, and then they went to Harvard together. And I think that their success maybe was because they were there together. And there's a, you know, contemporary nonprofit called the Posse Foundation, which says if you take one inner city kid and put him in an elite school, you don't just send one. You know, you send a few people who've shared that experience. And I think we also saw that in the military schools when they admitted several women they were successful. And I think that Joel and Caleb probably, I mean, this is my assumption, but I think that they relied very heavily on each other when they made that crossing into this alien world.
Right. And he's just been honored at Harvard for his own contributions.
Yes. It's been recognized that he did complete his degree, and it's been awarded to him, so he can take his place in the Society of Harvard alums.
Did you ever consider writing his story rather than Caleb's when you were planning the book?
I didn't, because he didn't grow up, as far as we know, in his own culture. His father was the first convert to Christianity.
Okay.
And moved very early to live at the edge of the English settlements. And I wanted to deal with his life is fascinating, and I think would be a wonderful subject for narrative history, because I think we've got a little bit more to go on than we have for Caleb. And maybe that's his job to do. But I really wanted to explore these very different worldviews coming into collision.
Yeah.
And so that's why I wanted to do it with Caleb.
I was supposed to travel to Newton, Massachusetts a year and a half ago to hear you speak with Anita Diamant.
Oh, yes. That was fun.
But I didn't get to go because there was a terrible snowstorm. But you're two of my favorites, and I know that you were both journalists before you took up fiction, and you did talk a little bit about your background in journalism, but I'm wondering if you can talk a tiny bit about how this background in journalism affected your fiction and how you draw on it now.
I think it totally affects it. It affects it in so many ways, in utilitarian ways. I think when you're a journalist for as long as I was, you just don't think about, can I write today? Is my aura on straight? You know, is the muse speaking to me? You know, well, I'm sorry, that doesn't work when you're a journalist. If you don't hand in your story, you will get the sack. So I'm very good about writing something every day, even if it's terrible, but at least you've got something down that you can work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way. But in a more, I think, significant way, for about a decade of my journalistic career, I was a foreign correspondent in places that were often in crisis, and that became unexpectedly my specialty, was going to difficult places in difficult times. And I saw the extremes of human behavior and how people are changed by catastrophe for better and for worse. And I draw on that constantly when I'm thinking about people responding to these long ago catastrophes. I think of people that I met in times of famine, or I met a woman who had been raised all her life to think that her existence would be circumscribed by the door of her house, and suddenly her husband is gone, missing, and if the family is going to survive, she's going to have to step out and lead them off to another country. And you see women capable of that kind of change, and it emboldens you to allow your fictional characters to change quite a bit in the course of the, you know, calamities and crises that they have to confront. And, you know, the experience of being at war, even as an observer, is harrowing, and you have memories that sometimes I wish I didn't have, but I do draw on them for my fiction. I will go to that darker place for my fiction.
Yeah. Do you miss it at all, being a journalist and traveling for that purpose?
There's been occasional stories that I've really wanted to cover, like the recent Green Revolution in Iran.
Yeah.
Because I find Iran completely fascinating, and the people there are so brave, and so many people who could have left have stayed to fight for the soul of their culture, which is a beautiful ancient culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to hear it belittled with, you know, ridiculous reductionist lines like axis of evil. You know, that is so ridiculous and offensive to traduce an entire culture in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But so I wanted to cover that one. And when the Taliban fell in Kabul, I would have loved to be there for that. But most of the time, I don't miss it because I'm so happy in this fictional home. And it's, to tell you the truth, it is so much more compatible with my other full-time job, which is being a mum.
Yeah.
And I love not having to answer the phone in the middle of the night and get up and go straight to the airport to get on a plane to some horrible, tragic catastrophe.
Yeah. You wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2001 about having read English books as a child, not Australian books, although you grew up in the western suburbs in Sydney. And then as you, you know, became a fiction writer, you wrote books that at that time you hadn't been writing Australian books. And really you still haven't written a book that I would say is strictly Australian, although your main character and people of the book is Australian. But
yeah, my second book is all about Australia, basically. It's a memoir called Foreign Correspondence, and it's about an Australian childhood in that time I was talking about, where we were still very much afflicted with a colonial mentality that everything came from somewhere else and culture was absolutely an import. And everything changed in my teen years, which was very formative for me, seeing the world change so quickly to where Australia was making the art and the movies that the rest of the world was reading all of a sudden. And but when I was growing up, we didn't think that way. And I haven't written a historical novel set in Australia yet. And largely, I think it's because the white history of Australia is just too recent. I really love this older... I love that period where the medieval mind is in conflict with the modern mind. And I think that that, you know, just pre-Enlightenment or early Enlightenment time, those people fascinate me because you can just start to recognize us in them. You get their jokes. They're becoming slightly cynical. They're starting to question religious orthodoxies, and I just really love them. And whereas, you know, the sort of early history of Australia, they're sort of, you know, early Victorian mentality, and that doesn't grab me as much. But there is one story there that I'm absolutely dying to tell, and as soon as I can be in a position to get back there for a year or so and really immerse myself in the place and time, I will do so.
Now, you share your time between Martha's Vineyard and, is it Sydney?
Sydney. Well, yeah, that's no longer, sad to say, as true as it used to be. Okay. I try and get back there as much as I can, but we don't live there for huge gobs of time the way we used to. When our oldest son was in elementary school, he had a school in Sydney and a school in the U.S., and he oscillated happily between them. But once he hit high school, it was either going to be here or there, and my husband's work at the time dictated that it would be here. So we're here for the duration of high school, how it is.
Sure, yeah.
It is a wonderful place. If you want to be in a city, I can't think of a city I'd rather be in than Sydney.
Right, yeah.
But I've also discovered that I'm not really a city person. I love the kind of more rural...
Yeah.
Ambience of where I am now.
Yeah.
And rural and beach is a fantastic combo as far as I'm concerned. So it's a sort of we're living a sort of a very, very old fashioned small town American life here, and it suits us. And I think when I am back in the city, I get so aggravated by things that you used to take for granted, like traffic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I sort of wonder, you know, am I still a Sydney-sider? Could I do this anymore every day?
Yeah. Well, I was going to, just getting back to the other article you wrote in the Wall Street Journal.
I think it was actually in the Washington Post.
Oh, it was?
I believe it was for Maria Rana when she was the book editor of the Washington Post.
Anyway, I was just going to mention that that when I was a kid, I always loved Enid Blyton as well, and... you know, I used to want to pack cheese sandwiches and camp out in old castles, and you can't do that in Ohio. So I was wondering, do you think that to some extent, in addition to what you've said about Australia and its history and its culture, do you think to some extent people who are going to be drawn toward writing are also drawn toward the strange and the exotic and the other?
I think there's two ways to go. As one of my Australian colleagues put it, you know, you can travel the world and be fascinated by otherness, or you can stay right at home and hone parochialism to an exquisitely fine edge. And I think some of my favorite writers do just that. They burrow into a very particular milieu and become so familiar with it. I mean, look at Jane Austen.
Right.
And my favorite Australian writer, Tim Winton, does that. I mean, he breathes and he's written, I think, only one book that's set outside of Western Australia. And I love his ability to just put you in a place and create every detail of it so perfectly. So I think that there's definitely, you know, at least two ways to approach it. I find that I love to explore something that I don't know well. and the freshness of it, being able to see something freshly and learn it from, you know, the ground up, and the nomenclature and the plants and the animals and what would they call this thing, and I love that.
Yeah. Well, I really just have one last question for you. The show that we're doing this interview for is for writers as well as readers. And my last question is for writers. Do you have any advice about how to help readers relate to and care about characters from far removed time periods and cultures and experiences?
I think it's the core belief of my novels is that the furniture can change as much as you like, but the human heart is constant. And the important things that shape us are the strong emotions of love and hate and fear of death. And I don't think we experience those any differently, even though we can do so much more to keep ourselves alive. I don't think that the fear is any less. And I think if you can give your characters a familiar emotional life, then all the other things that are different about them will not alienate the reader. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I believe.
Well, I think it must be working because your books are always so fascinating. And
well, thank you.
Well, Geraldine Brooks, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciated it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I love visiting Vermont, even vicariously.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Geraldine Brooks. To learn more about her work, check out her website, geraldinebrooks.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Geraldine Brooks. She keeps two poetry collections handy in her writing space and opens them when she needs inspiration. The first is Palgrave's Golden Treasury, and the second is the Norton Anthology. Open to a random page, read a poem, and then return to your writing. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement, and more information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music at 3 o'clock, which it now is actually 3:02. Sorry about that. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.